Thank you very much for that special music. That was very nice. Mr. Alls was kind enough to put these little fans up here. I think I'm going to turn them on, see how that works. It's kind of vibrant. Can you hear that? Maybe that won't work. Move it over. No. That's not going to work. Let's try a higher speed. No. Okay. Turn off. Okay. So let's talk about the arm, shall we? So Mr. Sexton brought it up. See, here's the scoop. So we have a meeting this evening at Mr. Sexton's home. And after the meeting or at sundown, he's got this 2,000-pound hot tub that he wants us to offload. So I thought, what better way to get out of that than feign some kind of injury on my arm, right? But seriously, I did injure my arm shoveling gravel. We did a bunch of landscaping this summer in my backyard. So obviously I'm not as young as I used to be, but I thought I could still shovel this gravel, a couple yards of it. But I wound up pulling the tendon away from the bone on this arm. And so I've got this wrap on it right now. I don't know if you can see it, but I've got to wear that for a while. It's got a kind of a button, a rubber pad, and you cinch it down tight, and it's supposed to push the tendon back against the bone. So anyway, but see, Mr. Sexton has zero sympathy and empathy when it comes to me. I've found out over the years, if he needs something done, suck it up, be there, right? Get it done. But I will also admit the fact that I have grounded out my golf club on occasion. And that does send a vibration through your body that you don't forget. And your arm will tingle for a while. And it can hurt. As a matter of fact, I've seen pros hurt themselves by doing that. But it's nice to be here with all of you. It's good to see the blue sky again and be able to breathe the air. Like Mr. Sexton was saying, it was pretty bad there for a while. We had dust on our cars, our driveway. Matter of fact, there was a big, I think it's moved over, but there's a big red ball on the screen earlier today when we got here. That's what the sun looked like for a few days. Just a giant red ball. I told Cheryl, wouldn't it be cool if we had the eclipse when the sun looked like that? And you could look at the sun, look directly at it. That would be kind of neat. So anyway, that's a story on my arm. We'll see what happens tonight. You know, in the scriptures, we find that we're given various titles or names with regards to our relationship with God the Father, Jesus Christ. I'll just mention a few. I'm not going to reference the scriptures that mention these because I'm going to assume that most of you probably know where these are. But we are called the children of God, the sons of God, God's chosen, the elect, the saints, the called out ones, the bride of Christ, though just to name a few. If you would, turn over to the Gospel of John, chapter 15. Let's begin there. The Gospel of John, chapter 15. I'm going to read verses 13 through 15. Jesus is talking with his disciples, and he gives them one definition of what real love means, or the ultimate demonstration of love. And he also added another element that I want to focus on this afternoon, found here in John chapter 15, beginning in verse 13. Jesus says, "Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends." And he said, "You are my friends, if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends. For all the things that I heard from my Father, I have made known to you." So this is a very powerful statement that Jesus made to his disciples here. He's telling them that they had the opportunity to transition from a position of a servant to one of a friend. If you consider the position of a servant, they would typically not be someone that you would spend a lot of time with and develop a relationship with as you would a friend. Now, once again, I'm assuming because I've never had a servant. And there is a possibility that owners of servants maybe developed a relationship with some of their servants, but not typically. So what you see here in the statement that Jesus made is quite a leap for his disciples. And that transition did not happen overnight. It was a process. The disciples had spent 3.5 years with Jesus Christ, and he made the statement to them shortly before his crucifixion. So, brethren, all of us here today have the same opportunity that Jesus Christ gave his disciples. See, our calling is an invitation to know God and to have a relationship with him. But God tells us that there is another step in that relationship, and that opportunity is to be called his friend, along with all the other names that I mentioned. And this opportunity is given only to a few, and it's an opportunity of a lifetime. So how can we become a friend of God? And when I say God, I reference both God the Father and Jesus Christ. We're here in John, so let's go over to John chapter 14. Let's read verses 6 and 7. I believe we understand this important dynamic, and that is if you have a relationship with one, then you have a relationship with both. There truly is no separation. That's been talked about in some of our other messages. But notice what Jesus said here in John 14, verse 6. Jesus said to him, "I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." And he says, "If you had known me, you would have known the Father also. And from now on, you know him and you have seen him." So knowing Jesus Christ is the same as knowing God the Father. So there are a lot of people that you hear about, but you personally do not know them. You only know them by the hearing of the ear and what others might tell you about them. Some that you hear about, you probably would not want to know them personally. Then there are those that are acquaintances, people that we work with, people that we see often, our neighbors, and so forth. The final category would be those people that are close friends. You know, and some of your friendships are very deep relationships forged by many years of being together. Proverbs 18:24, let me just read it to you. You don't have to turn over there. Proverbs 18:24 says this: "A man who has friends must himself be friendly." Very true statement. "But there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." And maybe you have a friend like that. But here are a few definitions written by someone about a friend. I'm not sure who wrote these, but I have them here in my notes. It says, "A friend is a man or a woman who knows all about you and still likes you." It says, "You can always tell a real friend when you've made a fool of yourself and he or she doesn't feel that you've done a permanent job." "A true friend is someone who thinks you're a good egg, even though you are half cracked." And finally, "A good friend is cheaper than therapy." And maybe some of you have found that out and saved yourself some money, otherwise spent speaking to counselors. Now, in my occupation as a sales rep, I meet a lot of people. I should say I have met a tremendous amount of people over the 30 years of my occupation. You've heard me talk about this before. Now let me say this. You know, as you get older, you start to repeat the same stories. I've heard the same stories many times from people and in messages. So the kids, then when I say the kids, I mean our family, they have this thing they do now. When Cheryl and I start to repeat the same story, they hold up their fingers. I don't know if you've ever seen that done before. So if you see two fingers, that means you've told the story twice. Three fingers, three times. So we'll start a story, and all of a sudden the fingers come up. And to be honest with you, I find it a little irritating. I want to tell my story. So, but this is what they start to do. Now, I don't want you to start doing that with the ministry, okay? Because we are going to tell the same stories over and over as I am doing now, telling about my occupation. Okay, so I regress. Back to my point. So, believe me, these individuals that I've met over the years run the full spectrum of personality types. And I'll say the majority have been good, ethical, nice people that I've met. Some have not been gifted with those traits that I've also met. But most have been business acquaintances, and a few I would call friends, but not close friends. They would never be close friends, and that's for a reason. One is because I've never had the desire to take that relationship to the next step. Because, you know, I realized if I did, it would be a dead-end street. It's not somewhere I wanted to go. But here's another definition of friendship, and I heard this before. It's definition. I believe I heard it in another message. I liked it, and I wrote it down. But it says a true friendship is developed when two individuals who are imperfect come together and realize that they are imperfect, and in spite of that, they find mutual common ground and are willing to accommodate the imperfections in each other. So that's another definition. So I'm going to give you the example. Since Mr. Sexton kind of opened the door here, I'm going to step through this door. So a little over 15 years ago, I believe it's been that long. It doesn't seem that long. I didn't really know Mr. Sexton. I had only heard of him by the hearing of the ear, like I said. I believe I met Patty before I ever met him. I remember Patty coming to the Vancouver church and talking to us about how to sell citrus, because she had done a tremendous job of that in Spokane, and I believe that's where they lived at the time. My oldest son and his youngest daughter were good friends, and because of that, we would see each other on occasion. But now we never spent a lot of time together. We just heard about each other. And then by chance, we were both transferred up to the Seattle-Tacoma area. My company transferred me up there in the year, I think it was 2000. And then shortly thereafter, Mr. Sexton came to work for United, and he moved up into the area. And so, of course, we began to know each other much better. But we found out we had similar backgrounds once we began to talk a lot. We had similar backgrounds growing up. Here you go. Here's that same story again, right? We both had the same 1959 Chevy Biscayne. Was that right? 1950. Now, I bought mine from my uncle for $20, and I guess he felt sorry for me. I didn't have a lot of money. I was, 16, I think, at the time, 16, 17. He sold it to me for $20. What was really interesting about this car, and I can't explain why, and he couldn't tell me either, but it had this giant white R on top of the car, giant white R. Of course, I said it meant Reeves, of course, but only thing I could figure is it was used to travel up the freeway, and they would clock it from a plane to see the mile markers, to clock them. That's the only thing I could figure out. Anyway, so I paid $20 for my car. I don't know if you'd ever told me what you paid for yours. How much? No way. $20? Oh, that's really hilarious. $20. Mine was only worth $20. I don't know about yours. I blew it up helping my friend deliver newspapers. So anyway. But anyway, we found out we had a lot of the same interest. We both enjoy outdoors. We like to hunt. We like to camp. He's younger than I. Mr. Sexton's younger than I am. But obviously I have more hair. He's a better shot with a gun than I am. I found that out. Him and I, we took a class to become master hunters together. And I tell you what, it was really enjoyable. It was like going back to college, you know, studying together. Problem was, we flunked the first time. they said only about, 85% of those who take that test the first time pass. So, I mean, you know, we barely missed it, but so we studied again and we passed it the second time. We got our master's hunting license together. So Mr. Sexton has a lot of talents that I don't have. Like I said, he's a better shot with a gun, but I can hit a golf ball. Not necessarily straight, but I can hit it. So, one thing that, I was very disappointed in when I found out this about him, and that is he likes Barry Manilow. And I don't. I don't like Barry Manilow. He tried to get me to go to a Barry Manilow concert, and I told him when, we had a member up north who hated fish, had never eaten fish, and I said, when that man eats fish, I'll go to a Barry Manilow concert. So, unfortunately, I heard he ate fish, so I don't know what's going to happen now. Maybe Barry's too old to have concerts anymore. So, we both, we became very good friends, and we enjoyed hanging out together, even though, you know, we might be quite different or have different interests. A lot of our interests are the same. But, you know, there are a number of men that are mentioned in the scriptures that we're told walked with God, and we're called a friend of God. We definitely don't have time to mention all of them. You know, we'd be here all day. But how did they reach that status, these men that walked with God, that were considered a friend of God's? So let's talk about a few of them. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 5. Genesis chapter 5 mentions the first one. You know, there's not a lot written about this man, but it does state that he walked with God, which is significant if you understand the implication of that. Here in Genesis chapter 5, verses 21 through 24, and it says, Enoch lived 65 years, and he begot Methuselah. And after he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. So it's talking about eventually he died. Now, if you look up the Hebrew word here, excuse me, for walk, that it's used, it means to walk alongside of, to walk alongside of, or to be conversant. So I think it would be safe to say that Enoch, because he walked alongside of God, talked with God, trusted God, had faith in God, Enoch was, I would assume, a friend of God. And if you notice, he had 365 years to develop that relationship. That's a long time, a very long time. Let's look at another example of another individual. Turn over to Genesis chapter 18. Genesis chapter 18. Now, while you're turning there, I'm going to read James chapter 2 and verse 23. You can jot it down, James 2, 23, which says this about this individual. James 2:23, it says, and the scripture was fulfilled which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. So James recorded that. So how well do you think Abraham knew God? Or maybe I should ask, how well do you think Abraham had to know God, to be called a friend of God? So imagine the relationship the two of them must have had for him to be called God's friend. So look, read this encounter here. This is in Genesis chapter 18, verse 1. This is a good depiction of their relationship. You know this story? Genesis 18, verse 1. And then the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. So he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them, and he bowed himself to the ground and said, "My Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass on by your servant. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. And I will bring you a morsel of bread that you may refresh your hearts. After that, you may pass by inasmuch as you come to your servant." And they said, "Do as you have said." So Abraham hurried to the tent to Sarah and said, "Quickly, make ready three measures of fine meal. Knead it and make cakes." And Abraham ran to the herd. He took a tender, young, good calf. He gave it to a young man, and he hastened to prepare it. So he took butter and milk and the calf which he had prepared, and he set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree as they ate. So now if you look at these verses, what Abraham asked his servants to do must have taken some time. So there must have been a conversation going on. We don't know exactly what all was said in their conversation, but all of this had to take time. Now, let's drop down for the sake of time to verse 16 here. So they ate the meal, and they had talked with Abraham, God had, about a few certain things. Then the men arose there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on his way. And the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm doing?" So you notice that relationship. God felt it was necessary to let Abraham know what he was going to do. "Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him." In verse 19, and God, he says this, "For I have known him." For I have known him. "In order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they may keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him." And the Lord said, "Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down and see whether they have done according to the outcry against it that has come to me. And if not, I will know." Then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom. But Abraham stood still before the Lord. And notice what he says here in verse 23. "And Abraham came near and said, 'Would you destroy the righteous with the wicked?'" So what did Abraham just do in this question that he asked the Lord here in verse 23? Abraham was simply reminding God of who he was and what he had said about himself. Hold your place here. Let's go over to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20, I'm going to read verses 4 through 6. So Abraham is reminding God of what he said, of who he was and what he had said about himself, because I said Abraham knew God, and God knew Abraham. Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. We know that this is God giving the Ten Commandments to Israel. And he says, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image of any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that's in the earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me." Verse 6, key verse. "But showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." So Abraham knew this about God. He knew this about God. He was reminding God about this. Also keep in mind who also lived in Sodom. All right, now let's go back to Genesis chapter 18. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 18. We're going to continue on with the story. Abraham continues this dialogue with the Lord, and it's interesting how he approaches this in this dialogue. And he says here, Genesis 18, verse 24, he says, "Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city, would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it?" And he says, "Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" So notice what Abraham notices or knows about God. That he's righteous and that he's also the judge of the earth. So the Lord said, "If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes." Then Abraham answered and said, "Indeed now I who am but dust and ashes have taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. Suppose there were 5 less than the 50 righteous. Would you destroy all the city for the lack of 5? And he said, "If I find there 45, I will not destroy it." And he spoke to him again and said, "Suppose there were 40 found there." So he said, "I will not do it for the sake of 40. Then he said, "Let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 should be found there." And he said, "I will not do it if I find 30. And he said, "Indeed now I have taken upon myself to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 should be found there." So he said, "I will not destroy it for the sake of 20. And then he said, "Let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak but once more. Suppose 10 should be found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. So the Lord went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Have you ever thought it was interesting that Abraham finished up at 10? Some commentary suggests that there is a good possibility that Lot's extended family could have been a total of at least 10 people. There's no way of knowing. It's just an assumption. But let's continue on with the story, because we're going to see that there is a possibility of that here in Genesis chapter 19. Turn over to Genesis chapter 9. Let's begin in verse 12. So the angels have come to the city, Sodom, and they've told Lot, "You need to get out quickly, because we're going to destroy it." So in verse 12, then the men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place. For we will destroy this place, because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out, and he spoke to his sons-in-law, who had married his daughters, and said, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city." But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. And when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your 2 daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." And so you know the rest of the story. The only ones that left was Lot and his wife and his 2 daughters. So only 4 of them escaped. And unfortunately, wife looked back, which she was instructed not to do, and she turned into a pillar of salt on that spot. But Abraham here was calling on God's mercy and sense of justice to save them if he could, save possibly his family, Lot's family, in Sodom. So Abraham knew God. God knew Abraham. And Abraham knew how God felt about the righteous and how God favored those who are righteous. And Abraham knew this because he was, as it says, a friend of God's. He had that kind of relationship. All right, let's take a look at one more. One third example over in Exodus chapter 33. This will be our last one. This is an example of a man that eventually knew God, come to know God and the relationship he had with God. Exodus chapter 33, verse 11. Just going to read one verse here. So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. And he would return to the camp, but his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. So once again, we see this relationship mentioned about Moses. Now let's go over to Numbers chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12, I'm going to read verses 1 through 10. Here's an example of how God felt about Moses. So look at this particular incident here. And you're going to see that God supported Moses and God had his back, as the saying goes. Numbers 12, verse 1. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman which he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. So they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? And then the Lord heard this. Now the man Moses was a very, very humble, more than all men who are on the face of the earth. Now notice how that is structured. One would assume it's structured in such a way that would imply that Moses, because he was a very humble man, and because of his humility, was not going to speak up for himself in the situation. But God was going to. Verse 4. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come out, you three, in the tabernacle of meeting. So the three came out. So you can see God's a little upset here. Then the Lord came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle, and he called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward. Then he said, hear now my words. If there's a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. So this is how God typically would work through one of his servants, a prophet. But he says, not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak to him face to face, even plainly, and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of the Lord. And he says, why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? So the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. Then Aaron turned toward Miriam, and there she was, a leper. So a very strong indication of the relationship that God had with Moses and how he felt about Aaron and Miriam when they challenged him. Now, ladies, for your benefit, I'll say this. You might have wondered why God didn't punish Aaron also in this situation and just Miriam. I don't know. Once again, a commentary that I read said it was possibly because Aaron could not have performed his priestly duties because he was the high priest. And if he had leprosy, he had to stay out of the camp. And so he could not have performed his priestly duties. So there's a good possibility. It makes sense, I guess. But God said he chose Moses, that he talked directly to Moses face to face and not to them. And so God defended Moses even when Moses wouldn't defend himself. So Moses was also a friend of God. Let me ask you this question. Did you know that following God is not always synonymous with knowing God? Once again, did you know that following God is not always synonymous with really knowing God? And that's what I mean. I mean not truly knowing God. One could lead to the other, but following and knowing are not necessarily synonymous. And there's a good example of that recorded for us that demonstrates my point. Let's go over to Job. Let's go over to Job. I'm going to start in Job chapter 1. Mr. Sexton read some of these verses last Sabbath, but I want to read them again to make my point. He read them to make a point that he made. I want to use them to make the point that I just read to you. Job chapter 1, let's begin in verse 1. It says, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and he shunned evil. Let's drop down to verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you ever considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? So how would you like to have those qualities that God just mentioned about Job on your report card? You read these sayings that God says about Job and you say, you know, Job really had his life together in regards to his relationship with God. Now let's go over to chapter 42. Even though Job displayed all these qualities, God still took issue with Job. And what was the issue or problem or a part of the problem with Job? We'll see it here in verse 42. Verse 1. Then Job answered the Lord and said, he says, I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. He says, you ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. And he said, listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. Key verse, verse 5. Notice what Job says. He says, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. So what is Job saying to God here? He's telling God, he said, I said things about you that I didn't really know or understand. I thought I knew you. I thought I knew how you did things, why you did things, and I said things about you that weren't true. Because I only knew you from what I had heard about you. But you have revealed yourself to me, and now I really know you, and I'm sorry, and I repent. So we see moving forward, not only did Job continue to follow God, but now Job truly knew God. So as I said, following and knowing are not necessarily synonymous. Have you ever met someone and spent time with them only to find out they weren't the person that you had been told they were? Whether it was good or bad? I'm sure you have. You know, we read in the stories of these great men and women in the scriptures, and we might think to ourselves, how could I ever be like an Enoch or an Abraham or a Moses or a Ruth or an Esther? They all had a very special relationship with God that I could never have. And part of that is true. Some had relationships, and God dealt with them in ways that he'll never deal with us. In this lifetime anyway, but someday we will. But nevertheless, we can know God as well as they did, and we can be a friend of God as these men did that I mentioned. And as I asked in the beginning, how can we do that? How can we do that? Well, first of all, if you want to know God, if you truly want to know God, once again, God the Father and Jesus Christ, Read about God. Read about God. What he wrote about himself and his son Jesus Christ. Because this is his autobiography right here. Is it not? Read about God. Earlier I gave you another definition of a human relation, a friendship. Like I said, this is not my definition. It's something I heard that I wrote down. But I said a close friendship is developed when two individuals who are imperfect come together and they agree that they are imperfect. And in spite of that, they find mutual common ground and they accommodate those imperfections. But here's something, brethren, that we need to realize, and this is very important. To be a friend of God is different than being a friend of someone who is imperfect. As I said, we all meet in the middle. We meet in the middle, we find common ground, and in spite of our imperfections, we remain friends. We're very forgiving towards one another. But with God, it's different because God is perfect. God sets a standard and God has certain defined requirements to be his friend. You've heard of some of those requirements that these men demonstrated that I mentioned so far, these three men. You heard some of those requirements. So God has standards. He has requirements. You see, God doesn't meet us where we're at. We have to progress towards him. We have to become like him. He doesn't accommodate our imperfections. God will forgive our imperfections, but he doesn't accommodate them like we do, so to speak, with each other. But it's a process and it's a friendship that takes time to develop. And that's part of our conversion process. But here's probably the most important foundational requirement of all to develop that relationship. We already read it once. I'm going to read it again. I'll just read it to you. Remember what Jesus said to his disciples. John 15:14. He said, "You are my friends if you do whatever I command you." So that relationship is conditional. I will ask you to turn over to 1 John. If you are in John chapter 15, you can kind of hold your place there, but let's go to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2, I'm going to read verses 3 and 4. John makes a very blunt statement here in 1 John chapter 2. No holds barred. It's just direct and very, very direct and to the point what he wrote. 1 John 2, verse 3. And he says, "Now by this we know that we know him." Do you catch that? "Now by this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. He who says, 'I know him,' and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him." You know, that's about as direct and blunt as you can get. When someone says, if you say something, it's not true, that you're lying. If an individual or a group of individuals claim they know God, if they claim they walk with God, they consider themselves friends of God, or say they love God, and yet they do not keep his commandments, they simply are not telling the truth. Plain and simple. John chapter 14, verse 15. John 14, verse 15. Very plainly, this is what Jesus said. He says, "If you love me, keep my commandments." You know, to most, love for God is a warm and fuzzy feeling. They have defined for themselves what it means to love God. And truly, only God can define what loving Him truly means. And He does that throughout the scriptures. We just read a few. Let me share this story with you. If I've told you this story before, you can do this. I can't remember if I have or not. A few years back on the 4th of July, Cheryl and I were invited to my oldest son's in-law's home for a barbecue. And then later that evening, we went down to Fort Vancouver to watch fireworks. And then we came back to their home. No, I take it back. We had the barbecue, then we went down and watched fireworks. That's right. You know, they're very nice people, and for the most part, we enjoy their company. Bruce, my son's father-in-law, is a minister. I think I've mentioned that. He's a minister in your typical community church. This dynamic, when we get together, can be make for some interesting conversations, to say the least, or conversations that are avoided. But for the most part, we avoid any deep biblical topics or religious conversations. But at this particular gathering, we're there with a few people. Most of the people there were good friends of theirs from their church, and there's a large group of young people. And so I mentioned to Jenny, Bruce's wife, I said, you know, after speaking to these young people, I have found them to be just very nice, polite, outgoing, and they seem to be successful young people. And her comment back to me was, yes, they are a great group of young people, and most importantly, the most important thing of all is that they all know and love Jesus. You know, as I stood there, 100 thoughts were flying through my air, through my head, a nanosecond, as she said this to me. And I stood there and I looked around. You know, you want to say something like, really? So they all obey the Ten Commandments and keep the seventh-day Sabbath, and you can go on and on, right? But for the sake of all, I just held my tongue and, you know, I just nodded my head and I said, that's nice. I said, that's nice. But isn't it amazing that people can say that they know God and love God, but yet ignore the requirements that God gives them to demonstrate that love? As I said, it's because they have defined what love for God truly means and not allowed God to define it. We're here in John chapter 14, so let's read beginning of verse 21. Verse 21 here in John chapter 14. Jesus said, "He who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me, and he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him." And Judas, not Iscariot, said to him, "Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world?" And Jesus answered and said to him, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word. And my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him." Remember, I said you cannot separate the two in our relationship with both of them. Verse 24, "He who does not love me does not keep my words, and the word which you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me." So, brethren, do you want to know God and be a friend of God and demonstrate to God that you truly love him? Then keep his commandments. That's why Abraham was called a friend of God. Genesis chapter 26, verses 4 and 5. You can turn there if you want. Genesis chapter 26, verses 4 and 5. God is speaking to Abraham here, and he says to Abraham, he says, "I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all the lands and your seed, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." Why? Because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. And God said this to Abraham hundreds of years before Mount Sinai. So to be a friend of God is conditional. It requires moving towards God and becoming more like God. It is to know how God thinks, how God feels, how God reacts in situations, and to know God's will. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 7, if you would, please. Matthew chapter 7, I'm going to read verses 21 through 23. The Feast of Trumpets is what? About a week and a half away? When Christ returns, whom will he gather to be with him in his kingdom? That's answered for us right here in Matthew chapter 7, beginning in verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. For many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied your name and cast out demons in your name and done many wonders in your name? And notice what he says here, verse 23. And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. I never knew you. I never had a relationship with you. You never developed a relationship with me. I never knew you. You did not know me. So he said, depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Once again, he brings in the Ten Commandments. So, brethren, does God know you? Does God know you as you know your closest friend? Does God have a better and stronger relationship with you than you have with your very closest and best friend? I would assume for those of you here today that are married, and if you're sitting next to your spouse, you're sitting next to your best friend. We've talked about that recently. Not only is your spouse your best friend, but you also have a relationship that only marriage can produce. Let's go to Revelation chapter 19. Revelation chapter 19. When Jesus Christ returns, he will be returning to greet those who know him, those who are his friends, and our relationship is going to be notched up even to a higher level. Revelation 19, verse 4. Let's read verses 4 through 9. And the 24 elders and the four living creatures fell down and worshiped God who sat on the throne, saying, Amen, Alleluia. Then a voice came from the throne saying, Praise our God, all you his servants and those who fear him, both small and great. And I heard, as it were, the voice of a great multitude, as a sound of many waters, and as a sound of mighty thundering, saying, Alleluia, for the Lord God omnipotent reigns. Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife has made herself ready. And to her it was granted to be arrayed with fine linen, clean and bright, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. Then he said to me, Write, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, These are the true sayings of God. So brethren, all of us here today have the opportunity to know God, to be called the friend of God, and someday be the bride of Jesus Christ. So to be a friend of God, we have to meet God where he is at. We've seen that there are conditions we must meet and standards we have to live by to be his friend. We also must realize it's God who defines what real love is, and we don't. So there is coming a time after the return of Jesus Christ that all mankind will be given the opportunity that we've been given now, and that is to truly know God. So, brethren, do you look forward to the day when Jesus Christ will say to you, face to face, it's good to meet you, my friend. And as the lyrics in a popular song say, I can only imagine.